The Man Behind Bin Laden. In March 2002, a band of horsemen journeyed through the province of Paktika in Afghanistan near the Pakistan border. Predator drones were circling the skies, and American troops were sweeping through the mountains. The war had begun 6 months earlier, and by now the fighting had narrowed down to the ragged eastern edge of the country. For 12 days, American and coalition forces had been bombing the nearby Shaikot Valley and systematically destroying the cave complexes in the Al-Qaeda stronghold. Regional warlords had been bought off, the borders supposedly sealed, and yet the horsemen were riding unhindered toward Pakistan. They came to the village of a local militia commander named Gula Jan, whose long beard and black turban might have signaled that he was a Taliban sympathizer. "I saw a heavy older man, an Arab, who wore dark glasses and had a white turban," John said 4 days later. "He was dressed like an Afghan, but he had a beautiful coat, and he was with 2 other Arabs who had masks on." The man in the beautiful coat dismounted and began talking in a polite and humorous manner. He asked John and an Afghan companion about the location of American and Northern Alliance troops. "We are afraid we will encounter them," he said. "Show us the right way." While the men were talking, John slipped away to examine a poster that had been dropped into the area by American airplanes. It showed a photograph of a man in a white turban and glasses. His face was broad and meaty, with a strong, prominent nose and full lips. His untrimmed beard was gray at the temples and ran in milky streaks below his chin. On his high forehead, framed by the swaths of his turban, was a darkened callus formed by many hours of prayerful prostration. His eyes reflected the sort of decisiveness one might expect in a medical man, but they also showed a measure of serenity that seemed oddly out of place. John was looking at a wanted poster for Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who had a price of $25 million on his head. John returned to the conversation. The man he now believed to be Zawahiri said to him, "May God bless you and keep you from the enemies of Islam. Try not to tell them where we came from and where we are going." There was a telephone number on the wanted poster, but Gula Jan did not have a phone. Zawahiri and the masked Arabs disappeared into the mountains. In June of 2001, 2 terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda and the Egyptian Islamist group, Al-Jihad, formally merged into one. The name of the new entity, Qaeda al-Jihad, reflects the long and interdependent history of these 2 groups. Although Osama bin Laden, the founder of Al-Qaeda, was the public face of Islamic terrorism, the members of al-Jihad and its guiding figure, Ayman al-Zawahiri, provided the backbone of the larger organization's leadership and was responsible for much of the planning of the terrorist operations against the United States, from the assault on American soldiers in Somalia in 1993 and the bombings of the American embassies in East Africa in 1998 and of the USS Cole in Yemen in 2000 to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th. Bin Laden and Zawahiri were bound to discover each other among the radical Islamists who were drawn to Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion in 1979. Bin Laden, who was in his early 20s, was already an international businessman. Zawahiri, 6 years older, was a surgeon from a notable Egyptian family. They saw in each other a solution to their dilemma. Bin Laden had followers, but they weren't organized. recalls Essam Deraz, an Egyptian filmmaker who made several documentaries about the Soviet-Afghan War. The people with Zawahiri had extraordinary capabilities. Doctors, engineers, soldiers. They had experience in secret work. They knew how to organize themselves and create cells. And they became the leaders. The goal of al-Jihad was to overthrow the civil government of Egypt and impose a theocracy that might eventually become a model for the entire Arab world. However, years of guerrilla warfare had left the group shattered and bankrupt. For Zawahiri, bin Laden was a savior, rich and generous, with nearly limitless resources, but also pliable and politically unformed. Bin Laden had an Islamic frame of reference, but he didn't have anything against the Arab regimes. Montasser al-Zayat, a lawyer for many of the Islamists, told me. When Ayman met bin Laden, he created a revolution inside him. 5 miles south of the chaos of Cairo is a quiet middle-class suburb called Mahdi. A consortium of Egyptian Jewish financiers intending to create a kind of English village amid the mango and guava plantations and Bedouin settlements on the eastern bank of the Nile began selling lots in the first decade of the 20th century. The developers regulated everything from the height of the garden fences to the color of the shutters on the grand villas that lined the streets. They planted eucalyptus trees to repel flies and mosquitoes, and gardens to perfume the air with the fragrance of roses and jasmine and bougainvillea. Many of the early settlers were British military officers and civil servants, whose wives started garden clubs and literary salons. They were followed by Jewish families, who by the end of the Second World War made up nearly a third of Mahdi's population. After the war, Mahdi evolved into a community of expatriate Europeans, American businessmen and missionaries, and a certain type of Egyptian, typically one who spoke French at dinner and followed the cricket matches. The center of this cosmopolitan community was the Mahdi Sporting Club, founded at a time when Egypt was occupied by the British. The club was unusual for admitting not only Jews, but Egyptians. Community business was often conducted on the all-sand 18-hole golf course with the Giza pyramids and the palmy Nile as a backdrop. As high tea was served to the British in the lounge, Nubian waiters, bearing icy glasses of Nescafe, glided among the pashas and princesses sunbathing at the pool. High-stepping flamingos waded through the lilies in the garden pond. The Mahdi Club became an ideal expression of the founder's vision of Egypt: sophisticated, safe, secular, and ethnically diverse, though still married to British notions of class. The careful regulations could not withstand the pressure of Cairo's burgeoning population. And in the late 1960s, another Mahdi took root. "We called its residents the Road 9 crowd," Samir Rafat, a journalist who has written a history of the suburb, told me. "It was very much them and us." Road 9 runs beside train tracks that separate the Tony side of Mahdi from the Baladi district, the native part of town. Here, donkey carts clop along unpaved streets past peanut vendors and yam salesmen hawking their wares and fly-studded carcasses hanging in butcher shops. There is also, on this side of town, a narrow slice of the middle class, composed mainly of teachers and low-level bureaucrats who were drawn to the suburb by the cleaner air and the dream of crossing the tracks and being welcomed into the club. In 1960, Dr. Rabi al-Zawahiri and his wife Umaima moved from Heliopolis to Mahdi. Rabi and Umayma belonged to two of the most prominent families in Egypt. The Zawahiri clan was creating a medical dynasty. Rabi was a professor of pharmacology at Ain Shams University in Cairo. His brother was a highly regarded dermatologist and an expert on venereal diseases. The tradition they established continued into the next generation. A 1995 obituary in a Cairo newspaper for one of their relatives, Kashif al-Zawahiri, mentioned 46 members of the family, 31 of whom were doctors or chemists or pharmacists. Among the others were an ambassador, a judge, and a member of parliament. The Zawahiri name, however, was associated above all with religion. In 1929, Rabi's uncle, Muhammad al-Ahmadi al-Zawahiri, became the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, the thousand-year-old university in the heart of Old Cairo, which is still the center of Islamic learning in the Middle East. The leader of that institution enjoys a kind of papal status in the Muslim world, and Imam Muhammad is still remembered as one of the university's great modernizers. Rabi's father and grandfather were Al-Azhar scholars as well. Umayma Azam, Rabi's wife, was from a clan that was equally distinguished, but wealthier and also a little notorious. Her father, Dr. Abdul Wahab Azam, was the president of Cairo University and the founder and director of King Saud University in Riyadh. He had also served at various times as the Egyptian ambassador to Pakistan, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia. Another relative was Secretary General of the Arab League. From the first parliament, more than 150 years ago, there have been Azams in government. Umayma's uncle, Mahfouz Azam, who is an attorney in Mahdi, told me. And we were always in the opposition. Mahfouz was a fervent Egyptian nationalist in his youth. "I was in prison when I was 15 years old," he said proudly. "They condemned me for making what they called a coup d'état." In 1945, Mahfouz was arrested again in a roundup of militants after the assassination of Prime Minister Ahmad Mahir. "I myself was going to do what Ayman has done," he said. Despite their pedigrees, Rabi and Umayma settled into an apartment on Street 100 on the Baladi side of the tracks. Later, they rented a duplex at number 10, Street 154, near the train station. High society held no interest for them. At a time when public displays of religious zeal were rare, and in Mahdi almost unheard of, the couple was religious, but not overtly pious. Umayma went about unveiled. There were more churches than mosques in the neighborhood, and a thriving synagogue. Children quickly filled the Zawahiri home. The first, Ayman, and a twin sister, Umnia, were born on June 19, 1951. The twins were extremely bright and were at the top of their classes all the way through medical school. A younger sister, Heba, also became a doctor. The two other children, Mohammed and Hussein, trained as architects. Obese, bald, and slightly cross-eyed, Rabi al-Zawahiri had a reputation as being eccentric and absent-minded, and yet he was beloved by his students and by the neighborhood children. He spent most of his time in the laboratory or in his private medical clinic. Professor Zawahiri's research occasionally took him to Czechoslovakia at a time when few Egyptians traveled because of currency restrictions. He always returned laden with toys for the children. He sometimes found time to take them to the movies at the Mahdi Sporting Club, which were open for non-members. Young Ayman loved the cartoons and Disney films, which played three nights a week on an outdoor screen. In the summer, the family went to a beach in Alexandria. Life on a professor's salary was constricted, especially with five ambitious children to educate. The Zawahiris never owned a car until Ayman was out of medical school. To economize, the family kept hens behind the house for fresh eggs, and the professor bought oranges and mangoes by the crate, which he pressed upon the children as a natural source of vitamin C. Umayma Azam was a wonderful cook, famous for her kunafa, a pastry of shredded phyllo filled with cheese and nuts and drenched in orange blossom syrup. She inherited several substantial plots of farmland in Giza and the Fayum oasis from her father, which provided her with a modest income. Ayman and his mother shared a love of literature. She always memorized the poems that Ayman sent her, Mahfouz Azam told me. Although Ayman maintained the Zawahiri medical tradition, he was actually closer in temperament to his mother's side of the family. The Zawahiris are professors and scientists, and they hate to speak of politics, Azam said. Ayman told me that his love of medicine was probably inherited, but politics was also in his genes. For anyone living in Mahdi in the 50s and 60s, there was one defining social standard: membership in the Mahdi Sporting Club. The whole activity of Mahdi revolved around the club, Samir Rafat, the historian of the suburb, told me one afternoon as he drove me around the neighborhood. If you are not a member, why even live in Mahdi? The Zawahiris never joined, which meant that Ayman would be curtained off from the center of power and status. He wasn't mainstream Mahdi. He was totally marginal Mahdi, Rafat said. The Zawahiris were a conservative family. You would never see them in the club, holding hands, playing bridge. We call them Saidis. Literally, the word refers to someone from a district in Upper Egypt, but we use it to mean something like hick. At one end of Mahdi, surrounded by green playing fields and tennis courts, is Victoria College, a private British-built preparatory school for boys. The students attended classes in coats and ties. One of its best-known graduates was a talented cricket player named Michel Chalhoub. After he became a film actor, he took the name Omar Sharif. Edward Said, the Palestinian scholar and author, attended the school, along with Jordan's future king, Hussein. Zawahiri, however, attended the state secondary school, a modest, low-slung building behind a green gate on the opposite side of the suburb. It was the hoodlum school, the other end of the social spectrum, Rafat told me. The students of the two schools existed in different worlds, never meeting each other, even in sports. Whereas Victoria College measured itself by European standards, the state school had its back to the west. Inside the green gate, the schoolyard was run by bullies, and the classrooms by tyrants. A physically vulnerable young boy such as Ayman had to create strategies to survive. Ayman's childhood pictures show him with a round face, a wary gaze, and a flat and unsmiling mouth. He was a bookworm and hated contact sports. He thought they were inhumane, according to his uncle Mahfouz. From an early age, he was devout, and he often attended prayers at the Hussein Sidki Mosque, an unimposing annex of a large apartment building. The mosque was named after a famous actor who renounced his profession because it was ungodly. No doubt Ayman's interest in religion seemed natural in a family with so many distinguished religious scholars, but it added to his image of being soft and otherworldly. Although Ayman was an excellent student, he often seemed to be daydreaming in class. He was a mysterious character, closed and introverted. Zaki Muhammad Zaki, a Cairo journalist who was a classmate of his, told me. He was extremely intelligent, and all the teachers respected him. He had a very systematic way of thinking, like that of an older guy. He could understand in 5 minutes what it would take other students an hour to understand. I would call him a genius. Once, to the family's surprise, Ayman skipped a test, and the principal sent a note to his father. The next morning, Professor Zawahiri met with the principal and told him, "From now on, you will have the honor of being the headmaster of Ayman al-Zawahiri. In the future, you will be proud." Indeed, that incident was never repeated. Ayman often showed a playful side at home. When he laughed, he would shake all over. "Yanni, it was from the heart," Mahfouz says. But at school, he held himself apart. There were a lot of activities in the high school, but he wanted to remain isolated, Zaki told me. It was as if mingling with the other boys would get him too distracted. When he saw us playing rough, he'd walk away. I felt he had a big puzzle inside him, something he wanted to protect. In 1950, the year before Ayman al-Zawahiri was born, Said Qutb, a well-known literary critic in Cairo, returned home after spending 2 years at Colorado State College of Education in Greeley. He had left Cairo as a secular writer who enjoyed a sinecure in the Ministry of Education. One of his early discoveries was a young writer named Nahib Mahfouz, who would win the 1988 Nobel Prize in Literature. "Qutb was our friend," Mahfouz recalled. "When I was growing up, he was the first critic to recognize me." Mahfouz, who was stabbed and nearly killed by an Islamic fundamentalist in 1994, said that before Qutb went to America, he was at odds with many of the sheikhs, who he thought were out of date. Qutb saw himself then as part of the modern age, and he wore his religion lightly. His great passion was Egyptian nationalism, and perhaps because of his strident opposition to the British occupation, the Ministry of Education decided that he would be safer in America. Qutb had studied American literature and popular culture, and he idealized the United States, which seemed to him and other Egyptian nationalists to be a friendly, neutral power and a democratic ideal. In Colorado, however, Qutb encountered a post-war America unlike the one he had found in books and Hollywood films. It is astonishing to realize, despite his advanced education and his perfectionism, how primitive the American really is in his views on life, Qutb wrote upon his return to Egypt. His behavior reminds us of the era of the caveman. He is primitive in the way he lusts after power, ignoring ideals and manners and principles. Qutb was impressed by the number of churches in America. There were more than 20 in Greeley alone, and yet the Americans he met seemed completely uninterested in spiritual matters. He was appalled to witness a dance in a church recreation hall, during which the minister, setting the mood for the couples, dimmed the lights and played, "Baby, It's Cold Outside." It is difficult to differentiate between a church and any other place that is set up for entertainment, or what they call in their language, fun, he wrote. The American was primitive in his art as well. Jazz is his preferred music, and it is created by Negroes to satisfy their love of noise and to whet their sexual desires, he concluded. He even complained about his haircuts. "Whenever I go to a barber, I return home and redo my hair with my own hands." In what he saw as the spiritual wasteland of America, Qutb recreated himself as a militant Muslim, and he returned to Egypt with the vision of an Islam that would throw off the vulgar influences of the West. Islamic society had to be purified, and the only mechanism powerful enough to cleanse it was the ancient and bloody instrument of jihad. Qutb was the most prominent theoretician of the fundamentalist movements. Zawahiri wrote in a brief memoir entitled Knights Under the Prophet's Banner in December 2001. Qutb said, "Brother, push ahead, for your path is soaked in blood. Do not turn your head right or left, but look only up to heaven." Qutb, a dark-skinned Egyptian, also brought home a new and abiding anger about race. "The white man in Europe or America is our number one enemy," he declared. "The white man crushes us underfoot while we teach our children about his civilization. We are endowing our children with amazement and respect for the master who tramples our honor and enslaves us. Let us instead plant the seeds of hatred, disgust, and revenge in the souls of these children. Let us teach these children from the time their nails are soft that the white man is the enemy of humanity, and that they should destroy him at the first opportunity." It is clear that Qutb was not just writing about America. His polemic was directed at Egyptians who wanted to bend Islam around the modern world. Modern values, secularism, rationality, tolerance, democracy, subjectivity, individualism, mixing of the sexes, materialism, had infected Islam through the agency of Western colonialism. His extraordinary project was to take apart the entire political and philosophical structure of modernity and return Islam to its unpolluted origins. Egypt was already in the midst of a revolution. The Society of Muslim Brothers, the oldest and most influential fundamentalist group in Egypt, instigated an uprising against the British, whose lingering occupation of the Suez Canal zone enraged the nationalists. In January 1952, in response to the British massacre of 50 Egyptian policemen, mobs organized by the Muslim Brothers in Cairo set fire to movie theaters, casinos, department stores, nightclubs, and automobile showrooms, which in their view represented an Egypt that had tied its future to the West. At least 30 people were killed, 750 buildings were destroyed, and 12,000 people were made homeless. The dream of a cosmopolitan metropolis ended, and the foreign community began its exodus. In July of that year, a military junta, dominated by an army colonel, Gamal Abdel Nasser, packed King Farouk onto his yacht and seized control of the government without firing a shot. According to several fellow conspirators who later wrote about the event, Nasser secretly promised the brothers that he would impose Sharia, the rule of Islamic law, on the country. A power struggle developed immediately between the leaders of the revolution, who had the army behind them, and the Muslim Brothers, who had a large presence in the mosques. Neither faction had the popular authority to rule. But as Nasser imposed martial law and eliminated political parties, the contest narrowed to a choice between a military society and a religious one, either of which would have been rejected by the majority of Egyptians had they been allowed to decide. Nasser threw Qutb into prison for the first time in 1954. 3 months later, he let him out and allowed him to become the head of the Muslim Brothers magazine, Al-Ikhwan Al-Muslimun. Presumably, he hoped that his display of mercy would enhance his standing with the Islamists and keep them from turning against the socialist and increasingly secular aims of the new government. One of the writers Qutb published was Zawahiri's uncle, Mahfuz Azam, who was then a young lawyer. Azam had known Qutb nearly all his life. "Said Qutb was my teacher," he told me. "He taught me Arabic grammar in 1936 and 1937. He came daily to our house. He held seminars and gave us books for discussion. The first book he asked me to write a report on was, What Did the World Lose with the Decline of the Muslims?" It quickly became obvious to Nasser that Qutb and his core of young Islamists had a different agenda for Egyptian society from his, and he shut down the magazine after its first few issues. But the religious faction was not so easily controlled. The struggle for Egypt's future reached a climax on the night of October 26, 1954, as Nasser spoke before an immense crowd in Alexandria. The entire country was listening to the radio as a member of the Muslim Brothers stepped forward and fired 8 shots at the Egyptian president, wounding a guard but missing Nasser. Nasser responded by having 6 conspirators executed immediately and arresting more than 1,000 others, including Qutb. He had crushed the brothers once and for all, he thought. Stories about Said Qutb's suffering in prison have formed a kind of passion play for Islamic fundamentalists. Qutb had a high fever when he was arrested, but the state security officers handcuffed him and took him to prison. He fainted several times on the way. For several hours he was kept in a cell with vicious dogs, and then during long periods of interrogation he was beaten. His trial was overseen by 3 judges, one of whom was a future president of Egypt, Anwar Sadat. In the courtroom, Qutb ripped off his shirt to display the marks of torture. The judges sentenced him to life in prison. But when Qutb's health deteriorated further, they reduced the sentence to 15 years. He suffered chronic bouts of angina, and it is likely that he contracted tuberculosis in the prison hospital. One line of thinking proposes that America's tragedy on September 11th was born in the prisons of Egypt. Human rights advocates in Cairo argue that torture created an appetite for revenge, first in Said Qutb and later in his acolytes, including Ayman al-Zawahiri. The main target of their wrath was the secular Egyptian government, but a powerful current of anger was directed toward the West, which they saw as an enabling force behind the repressive regime. They held the West responsible for corrupting and humiliating Islamic society. Indeed, the theme of humiliation, which is the essence of torture, is important to understanding the Islamists' rage against the West. Egypt's prisons became a factory for producing militants whose need for retribution, they called it justice, was all-consuming. The hardening of Qutb's views can be traced in his prison writings. Through friends, he managed to smuggle out, bit by bit, a manifesto titled Milestones, Ma'alim fi al-Tariq. The manuscript circulated underground for years. It was finally published in Cairo in 1964 and was quickly banned. Anyone caught with a copy could be charged with sedition. Its ringing apocalyptic tone may be compared with Rousseau's The Social Contract and Lenin's What is to be Done, with similar bloody consequences. Qutb begins, "Mankind today is on the brink of a precipice. Humanity is threatened not only by nuclear annihilation, but by the absence of values. The West has lost its vitality, and Marxism has failed. At this crucial and bewildering juncture, the turn of Islam and the Muslim community has arrived." Qutb divides the world into two camps, Islam and Jahiliya. The latter, in traditional Islamic discourse, refers to a period of ignorance that existed throughout the world before the Prophet Muhammad began receiving his divine revelations in the 7th century. For Qutb, the entire modern world, including so-called Muslim societies, is Jahiliya. This was his most revolutionary statement, one that placed nominally Islamic governments in the crosshairs of jihad. The Muslim community has long ago vanished from existence, he contends. It is crushed under the weight of those false laws and customs which are not even remotely related to Islamic teachings. Humanity cannot be saved unless Muslims recapture the glory of their earliest and purest expression. He writes, "We need to initiate the movement of Islamic revival in some Muslim country, in order to fashion an example that will eventually lead Islam to its destiny of world dominion. There should be a vanguard which sets out with this determination and then keeps walking on the path." These words would echo in the ears of young Muslims who were looking for a role to play in history. Qutb was hanged after dawn prayers on August 29, 1966. The Nasserite regime thought that the Islamic movement received a deadly blow with the execution of Sayyid Qutb and his comrades, Zawahiri observes in his memoir. But the apparent surface calm concealed an immediate interaction with Sayyid Qutb's ideas and the formation of the nucleus of the modern Islamic Jihad movement in Egypt. The same year Qutb was hanged, Zawahiri helped to form an underground militant cell dedicated to replacing the secular Egyptian government with an Islamic one. He was 15 years old. "We were a group of students from Mahdi High School and other schools," Zawahiri testified about his days as a young radical when he was put on trial in 1981 for conspiring in the assassination of President Sadat. The members of his cell usually met in one another's homes. Sometimes they got together at a mosque and then went to a park or to a quiet spot on the tree-lined corniche along the Nile. In the beginning, there were five members, and before long, Zawahiri became the emir, or leader. "Our means didn't match our aspirations," he conceded in his testimony, but he never seemed to question his decision to become a revolutionary. "Bin Laden had a turning point in his life," Zawahiri's cousin Omar Azam pointed out. "But Ayman and his brother Muhammad were like people in school moving naturally from one grade to another. You cannot say those boys were naughty guys or playboys, then turned 180 degrees. To be honest, if Ayman and Muhammad repeated their lives, they would live them the same way." Under the monarchy, before Nasser's assumption of power, the affluent residents of Mahdi had been insulated from the whims of the government. In revolutionary Egypt, they suddenly found themselves vulnerable. The kids noticed that their parents were frightened and afraid of expressing their opinions, Zawahiri's former schoolmate Zaki told me. It was a climate that encouraged underground work. Clandestine groups like Zawahiri's were forming all over Egypt. Made up mainly of restless or alienated students, they were small and disorganized and largely unaware of one another. Then came the 1967 war with Israel. The speed and the decisiveness of Israel's victory in the Six-Day War humiliated Muslims who had believed that God favored their cause. They lost not only their armies and territory, but also faith in their leaders, in their countries, and in themselves. For many Muslims, it was as though they had been defeated by a force far larger than the tiny country of Israel. by something unfathomable, modernity itself. The profound appeal of Islamic fundamentalism in Egypt and elsewhere was born in this shocking debacle. A newly strident voice was heard in the mosques, one that answered despair with a simple formulation. Islam is the solution. The clandestine Islamist groups were galvanized by the war, and their primary target was Nasser's secular regime. In the terminology of jihad, the priority was to defeat the near enemy, that is, impure Muslim society. The distant enemy, the West, could wait until Islam had reformed itself. For the Islamists, this meant, at a minimum, imposing Sharia on the Egyptian legal system. Zawahiri also wanted to restore the caliphate, the rule of Islamic clerics, which had formally ended in 1924 after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, but had not exercised real power since the 13th century. Once the caliphate was re-established, Zawahiri believed, Egypt would become a rallying point for the rest of the Islamic world. He later wrote, "Then history would make a new turn, God willing, in the opposite direction, against the empire of the United States and the world's Jewish government." Nasser died of a heart attack in 1970. His successor, Sadat, desperately needed to establish his political legitimacy, and he quickly set about trying to make peace with the Islamists. Saad Eddin Ibrahim, a dissident sociologist at the American University in Cairo and an advocate of democratic reforms who spent 7 years in prison, told me, "Sadat was looking around for allies. He remembers the Muslim brothers. Where are they? In prison. He offers the brothers a deal. In return for their political support, he'll allow them to preach and to advocate as long as they don't use violence." What Sadat didn't know was that the Islamists were split. Some of them had been inspired by Qutb. The younger, more radical ones thought that the older ones had gone soft. Sadat emptied the prisons, miscalculating the peril that the Islamists posed to his regime. The Muslim Brothers, who were forbidden to act as a genuine political party, began colonizing professional and student unions. By 1973, a new band of young fundamentalists had appeared on campuses, first in the southern part of the country, then in Cairo. They called themselves Al-Gamma Al-Islamiyya, the Islamic group. Encouraged by Sadat's acquiescent government, which covertly provided them with arms so that they could defend themselves against any attacks by Marxists and Nasserites, the Islamic group radicalized most of Egypt's universities. Soon it became fashionable for male students to grow beards and female students to wear the veil. Zawahiri kept his underground life a secret, even from his family, but he would later claim that his group had grown to 40 members by 1974 when he was attending medical school at Cairo University. Zawahiri was tall and slender, and he wore a mustache that paralleled the flat lines of his mouth. His face was thin, and his hairline was in retreat. He dressed in Western clothes, usually a coat and tie. He did not completely hide his political feelings, however. He once gave a campus tour to an American newsman, Abdallah Schleifer, a gangly, wiry-haired man who wore a goatee, a throwback to his beatnik phase in the late 50s. Schleifer was a challenging figure in Zawahiri's life. He was brought up in a non-observant Jewish family on Long Island. He went through a Marxist period, and then, during a trip to Morocco in 1962, he encountered the Sufi tradition of Islam. One meaning of the word Islam is to surrender, and that is what happened to Schleifer. He converted, changed his name from Mark to Abdallah, and spent the rest of his professional life in the Middle East. In 1974, when Schleifer first came to Cairo as the bureau chief for NBC News, Zawahiri's uncle Mahfouz Azam became a kind of sponsor for him. Converts often get adopted, and Mahfouz was fascinating, Schleifer told me. To him, it was sort of a gas that an American had taken to Islam. I had the feeling I was under the protection of the whole Azam family. Through Mahfouz, Schleifer met Zawahiri, who agreed to show him around the campus to get a better understanding of the scene. He was scrawny, and his eyeglasses were extremely prominent, Schleifer said. He looked like a left-wing City College intellectual of 30 years earlier. During the tour, Zawahiri proudly pointed out students who were painting posters for political demonstrations, and he boasted that the Islamist movement had found its greatest recruiting success in the university's two most elite faculties, the medical and engineering schools. "Aren't you impressed by that?" he said. Schleifer patronized him. He observed that in the 60s, those same faculties had been strongholds of the Marxist youth. The Islamist movement, he observed, was merely the latest trend in student rebellions. "Listen, Ayman, I'm an ex-Marxist," Schleifer said. "When you talk, I feel like I'm back in the party. I don't feel as if I'm with a traditional Muslim." Zawahiri listened politely. "We parted on a friendly note," Schleifer said, "but I think he was puzzled." Schleifer encountered Zawahiri again at a celebration of the Eid festival, one of the holiest days in the Muslim calendar. "I heard they were going to have outdoor prayer in the Farouk Mosque in Mahdi," he recalled, "so I thought, great, I'll go pray in their lovely garden. And who do I see but Ayman and one of his brothers? They were very intense. They laid out plastic prayer mats and set up a microphone." What was supposed to be a meditative day of chanting the Quran turned into a contest between the congregation and the Zawahiri brothers with their microphone. I realized that they were introducing the Salafist formula, which does not recognize any Islamic traditions after the time of the Prophet. It was chaotic. Afterward, I went over to Zawahiri and said, "Ayman, this is wrong." He started to explain. I said, "I'm not going to argue with you. I'm a Sufi and you're a Salafist. But you are making fitna," a term for stirring up trouble, which is proscribed by the Quran. "And if you want to do that, you should do it in your own mosque." Zawahiri meekly responded, "You're right, Abdallah." Zawahiri graduated from medical school in 1974, then spent 3 years as a surgeon in the Egyptian army, posted at a base outside Cairo. He was now in his late 20s, and it was time for him to marry. He had never had a girlfriend. "Our custom is to have friends or relations suggest a spouse," his cousin Omar told me. "If they find acceptance, they are allowed to meet once or twice, then start the engagement. It's not a love story." One of the possible brides suggested to Ayman was Aza Noer, the daughter of a prominent Cairo family. Both her parents were lawyers. In another time, she might have become a professional woman herself, or a socialite going to parties at the sporting club. But at Cairo University, she adopted the hijab, the headscarf that has become a badge of conservatism among Muslim women. Aza's decision to veil herself was a shocking disavowal of her class. Before that, she had worn the latest fashions. Her older brother Esam told me, "We didn't want her to be so religious. She started to pray a lot and read the Quran, and little by little she changed completely." Soon Aza went further and put on the niqab, the veil that covers a woman's face below the eyes. According to her brother, Azza spent whole nights in spiritual meditation. When he woke in the morning, he would find her sitting on the prayer mat with the Quran in her hands, fast asleep. The niqab imposed a formidable barrier for a marriageable young woman. Because of Azza's wealthy, distinguished family, she had many suitors, but they all insisted that she drop the veil. Azza refused. She wanted someone who would accept her as she was, her brother told me. Ayman was looking for that type of person. At the first meeting between Azza and Ayman, according to custom, Azza lifted her veil for a few minutes. He saw her face, and then he left, Esam said. The young couple talked briefly on one other occasion after that, but it was little more than a formality. Ayman never saw his fiancée's face again until after the marriage ceremony. He had made a favorable impression on the Noer family, who were a little dazzled by his distinguished ancestry. He was polite and agreeable, Esam said. He was very religious, and he didn't greet women. He wouldn't even look at a woman if she was wearing a short skirt. He apparently never talked about politics with Azza's family, and it's not clear how much he revealed about his activism to her. She once confided to Omar Azam that her greatest desire was to become a martyr. Their wedding was held in February 1978 at the Continental Savoy Hotel, which had slipped from colonial grandeur into dowdy respectability. According to the wishes of the bride and groom, there was no music, and photographs were forbidden. It was pseudo-traditional, Schleifer recalled. Lots of cups of coffee, and no one cracking jokes. My connection with Afghanistan began in the summer of 1980 by a twist of fate, Zawahiri writes in his memoir. The director of a Muslim Brothers clinic in Cairo asked if Zawahiri would like to accompany him to Pakistan to tend to the Afghan refugees. Thousands were fleeing across the border as a result of the Soviet invasion, which had begun a few months earlier. Although he had recently gotten married, Zawahiri writes that he immediately agreed. He had been preoccupied with the problem of finding a secure base for jihad, which seemed practically impossible in Egypt. The River Nile runs in its narrow valley between two deserts that have no vegetation or water, he laments. Such a terrain made guerrilla warfare in Egypt impossible, and as a result, forced the inhabitants of this valley to submit to the central government and to be exploited as workers and compelled them to be recruited into its army. Perhaps Pakistan or Afghanistan would prove a more suitable location for raising an army of radical Islamists who could eventually return to take over Egypt. Zawahiri traveled to Peshawar with an anesthesiologist and a plastic surgeon. We were the first three Arabs to arrive there to participate in relief work, he writes. He spent 4 months in Pakistan working for the Red Crescent Society, the Islamic arm of the Red Cross. Peshawar sits at the eastern end of the Khyber Pass, the historic concourse of invading armies since the days of Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan. After the British abandoned the area in 1947, Peshawar again became a quiet farming town, and the gates to the city were closed at midnight. When Zawahiri arrived, however, it was teeming with arms merchants and opium dealers. Young men from other Muslim countries were beginning to hear the call of jihad, and they came to Peshawar, often with nothing more than a phone number in their pockets, and sometimes without even that. Their goal was to become shaheed, a martyr, and they asked only to be pointed in the direction of the war. Osama bin Laden was one of the first to arrive. He spent much of his time shuttling between Peshawar and Saudi Arabia, raising money for the cause. The city also had to cope with the influx of uprooted and starving Afghans. By the end of 1980, there were 1.4 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan, a number that nearly doubled the following year. And almost all of them came through Peshawar, seeking shelter in nearby camps. Many of the refugees were casualties of Soviet landmines or of the intensive bombing of towns and cities. The conditions in the clinics and hospitals were appalling. Zawahiri reported that he sometimes had to use honey to sterilize wounds. Through connections with local tribesmen, Zawahiri made several trips across the border into Afghanistan. He was one of the first outsiders to witness the courage of the Afghan freedom fighters, who called themselves the Mujahideen, the Holy Warriors. They were defending themselves on foot or on horseback with First World War carbines. American Stinger missiles would not be delivered until 1986, and Eastern Bloc weapons that the CIA had smuggled in were not yet in the hands of the fighters. But the Mujahideen already sensed that they were becoming pawns in the superpowers' game. That fall, Zawahiri returned to Cairo full of stories about the miracles that were taking place in the jihad against the Soviets. He had grown a beard and was affecting a Pakistani outfit, a long tunic over loose trousers. When a delegation of Mujahideen leaders came to Cairo, Zawahiri took his uncle Mahfouz to the venerable Shepherd Hotel to meet them. Zawahiri presented an idea that had come from Abdallah Schleifer. As the NBC bureau chief, Schleifer had been frustrated by the inability of Western news organizations to get close to the war. He said to Zawahiri, "Send me three bright young Afghans, and I'll train them to use film, and they can start telling their story." When Schleifer called on Zawahiri to discuss the proposal, he was surprised by his manner. He started off by saying that the Americans were the real enemy and had to be confronted, Schleifer told me. I said, "I don't understand. You just came back from Afghanistan, where you're cooperating with the Americans. Now you're saying America is the enemy?" "Sure, we're taking American help to fight the Russians," Zawahiri replied. "But they're equally evil." "How can you make such a comparison?" Schleifer said. "There's more freedom to practice Islam in America than here in Egypt. And in Afghanistan, the Soviets closed down 50,000 mosques." Schleifer recalled. The conversation ended on a bad note. "In our previous debates, it was always eye to eye, and you could break the tension with a joke. Now I felt that he wasn't talking to me. He was addressing a mass rally of 100,000 people. It was all rhetoric." Nothing came of Schleifer's offer. Zawahiri returned to Peshawar for another tour of duty with the Red Crescent Society in March of 1981. This time he cut his stay short and returned to Cairo after 2 months. He wrote in his memoir that he regarded the Afghan jihad as a training course of the utmost importance to prepare the Muslim Mujahideen to wage their awaited battle against the superpower that now has sole dominance over the globe, namely the United States. Islamic militancy had become a devastating force throughout the Middle East. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini had returned to Iran from Paris in 1979 and led the first successful Islamist takeover of a major country. When Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the exiled Shah, sought treatment for cancer in the United States, the Ayatollah incited student mobs to attack the American embassy in Tehran. They held 52 Americans hostage, and the United States severed all diplomatic ties with Iran. For Muslims everywhere, Khomeini reframed the debate with the West. Instead of conceding the future of Islam to a secular democratic model, he imposed a stunning reversal. His sermons summoned up the unyielding force of the Islam of a previous millennium in language that foreshadowed bin Laden's revolutionary diatribes. The specific target of his anger against the West was freedom. "Yes, we are reactionaries, and you are enlightened intellectuals. You intellectuals do not want us to go back 1,400 years, he said immediately after the revolution. "You who want freedom, freedom for everything, the freedom of parties. You who want all the freedoms, you intellectuals, freedom that will corrupt our youth, freedom that will pave the way for the oppressor, freedom that will drag our nation to the bottom." As early as the 1940s, Khomeini had signaled his readiness to use terror to humiliate the perceived enemies of Islam, providing theological cover in addition to material support. "People cannot be made obedient except with the sword. The sword is the key to paradise, which can be opened only for holy warriors." This defiant turn against democratic values had been implicit in the writings of Qutb and other early Islamists, and it now shaped the Islamist agenda. The overnight transformation of a relatively wealthy, powerful, modern country such as Iran into a rigid theocracy proved that the Islamists' dream was eminently achievable, and it quickened their desire to act. In Egypt, President Sadat called Khomeini a lunatic madman who has turned Islam into a mockery. Sadat invited the ailing Shah to take up residence in Egypt, and he died there the following year. In April of 1979, Egyptians voted to approve the peace treaty with Israel, which had been celebrated with a three-way handshake between President Jimmy Carter, Sadat, and the Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin on the White House lawn a few months earlier. The referendum was such a charade. 99.9% of the voters reportedly approved it, that it underscored how dangerous Sadat's decision to make peace was. In response to a series of demonstrations orchestrated by the Islamists, Sadat banned all religious student associations. Reversing his position of tolerating these groups, he now declared, "Those who wish to practice Islam can go to the mosques, and those who wish to engage in politics may do so through legal institutions." The Islamists insisted that their religion did not permit such distinctions. Islam was a total system that encompassed all of life, including law and government. Sadat went as far as to ban the niqab at universities. Many who said that he had signed his death warrant when he made peace with Israel now also characterized him as a heretic. Under Islamic law, that was an open invitation to assassination. Zawahiri envisioned not merely the removal of the head of state, but a complete overthrow of the existing order. Stealthily, he had been recruiting officers from the Egyptian military, waiting for the moment when his group had accumulated enough strength in men and weapons to act. His chief strategist was Abud al-Zumar, a military hero of the 1973 war with Israel. Zumar's plan was to kill the most powerful Egyptian leaders and capture the headquarters of the army and the state security, the telephone exchange building, and the radio and television building. From there, news of the Islamic Revolution would be broadcast, unleashing, he expected, a popular uprising against secular authority all over the country. It was, Zawahiri later testified, an elaborate, artistic plan. One of the members of Zawahiri's cell was a daring tank commander named Issam al-Kamari. Zawahiri, in his memoir, characterizes Kamari as a noble person in the true sense of the word. "Most of the sufferings and sacrifices that he endured willingly and calmly were the result of his honorable character," Although Zawahiri was the senior member of the Mahdi cell, he often deferred to Kamari, who had a natural sense of command, a quality that Zawahiri notably lacked. Indeed, Kamari saw that there was something missing in Zawahiri, and once cautioned him, "No matter what group you belong to, you cannot be its leader." Kamari began smuggling weapons and ammunition from army strongholds and storing them in Zawahiri's medical clinic in Mahdi. In February of 1981, as the weapons were being transferred, police arrested a man carrying a bag loaded with guns, along with maps that showed the location of all the tank emplacements in Cairo. Kamari, realizing that he would soon be implicated, dropped out of sight. But several of his officers were arrested. Zawahiri, inexplicably, stayed put. The evidence gathered in these arrests alerted government officials to a new threat from the Islamist underground. That September, Sadat ordered a roundup of more than 1,500 people, including many prominent Egyptians. Not only Islamists, but also intellectuals with no religious leanings. Marxists, Coptic Christians, student leaders, and various journalists and writers. The dragnet missed Zawahiri, but captured most of the other leaders of his group. However, a military cell within the scattered ranks of al-Jihad had already set in motion a hastily conceived plan. A young army recruit, Lieutenant Khaled Islambouli, had offered to kill Sadat during an appearance at a military parade the following month. Zawahiri later testified that he did not learn of the plan until 9 o'clock on the morning of October 6th, 1981, a few hours before it was scheduled to take place. One of the members of his cell, a pharmacist, brought him the news at his clinic. "In fact, I was astonished and shaken," Zawahiri told interrogators. In his opinion, the action had not been properly thought through. The pharmacist proposed that they do something to help the plan succeed. "But I told him, 'What can we do?'" Zawahiri told the interrogators. He said that he felt it was hopeless to try to aid the conspirators. "Do they want us to shoot up the streets and let the police detain us? We are not going to do anything." Zawahiri went back to his patient. When he learned a few hours later that the military exhibition was still in progress, he assumed that the operation had failed and that everyone connected with it had been arrested. The parade commemorated the 8th anniversary of the 1973 war. Surrounded by dignitaries, including several American diplomats, President Sadat was saluting the troops when a military vehicle veered toward the reviewing stand. Lieutenant Islambouli and three other conspirators leaped out and tossed grenades into the stand. "I have killed the Pharaoh," Islambouli cried after emptying the cartridge of his machine gun into the president, who stood defiantly at attention until his body was riddled with bullets. It is still unclear why Zawahiri did not leave Egypt when the new government, headed by Hosni Mubarak, rounded up 700 suspected conspirators. In any event, at the end of October, Zawahiri packed his belongings for another trip to Pakistan. He went to the house of some relatives to say goodbye. His brother Hussein was driving him to the airport when the police stopped them on the Nile Corniche. "They took Ayman to the Mahdi police station, and he was surrounded by guards," Omar Azam recalled. "The chief of police slapped him in the face, and Ayman slapped him back." Omar and his father, Mahfouz, recall this incident with amazement, not only because of the recklessness of Zawahiri's response, but also because until that moment, they had never seen him resort to violence. After his arrest and imprisonment, Zawahiri became known as the man who struck back.